the edge of our hope, at the end of our time. We have chosen not only to believe in ourselves, but in each other. Today we face the monsters that are at our door. Today we are canceling the apocalypse.
Now get the hell out of our galaxy.
The strength of this starship lay in its diversity.
You see, our glorious diversity, that is not a threat to who we are. It makes us who we are.
You don't just let things happen. You make a stand. You say no. You have the guts to do what's right when everyone else just runs away.
But we must fight this darkness that is threatening to engulf us. Each of us must be a ray of hope.
Rebellions are built on hope.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanty Show. Today we'll be talking about the immigrant experience in science fiction and fantasy writing. I'm Julia, and today our guest is Sabrina Vorvulius. Welcome, Sabrina.
Hi, Julia. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, thank you so much for joining us. So, Sabrina, you're the author of Ink, which is a novel about immigrants and the immigrant experience and Latino experience in the U.S. You've written many short stories and poems. You are yourself an immigrant who has an interesting story, and I know you've worked a lot with the Latino community in the United States. So tell us a little bit about your background. When did you come here? When did you start writing science fiction? And how has your experience informed your writing?
Sure. I came to the U.S. in 1975 from Guatemala. The sort of the prompt for us to come here was that my father had been kidnapped and was really in danger. He negotiated his release, but part of his negotiated release was that he was contacted over and over again by his kidnappers, and in every instance, essentially, his family were threatened, and so he uprooted us all and brought us here. My mother was Guatemalan. He was an American citizen who had grown up in Colombia and in Mexico, and in many ways was really an American who had spent the vast majority of his life outside of the United States. And we, because he was an American citizen and a very proud person, we, my brothers and I, although none of us are born in the United States, we were all American citizens from birth. And so we came to the States with our citizenship, but without ever having lived here, and with a real cultural gulf in terms of what we knew about the States, and much of my storytelling really was shaped by certain specifics about my life and the period of time in Guatemala when we were there. It was during the 36-year Civil War. There was a great deal of violence in the streets. There was a great deal of governmental repression. And those aspects of everyday life are something that continue to permeate my storytelling. And at the same time, you know, I was hearing from my earliest years myths and legends from pre-Spanish colonial times, from Spanish colonial times, from folklore, living folklore, all sorts of wonderful stories that involved everyday style of magical and supernatural occurrence that were really, you know, shaping my voice at the same time as living through essentially an undeclared civil war was shaping my voice. And so as a little kid in Guatemala, I wrote really prose poetry. That's what I first started with. And I wrote it in English and Spanish. And, you know, predictably enough, you know, I wrote about I wrote about fairies, and I wrote about, you know, any number of sort of recurring type of fantastical creatures like dwarves or duendes of all sorts. And I really didn't write fiction until well after I had moved to the United States when I was in college. As a lark, I took a fiction writing course with Alan Gerganis, and I didn't take it very seriously in a lot of ways. I sort of just knew I was never going to be a writer, a fiction writer. But I absolutely adored the process of it, and he was a wonderful teacher, and very encouraging. And then I just, you know, like life took me into journalism instead of any other form of writing. And it wasn't till, you know, the maybe 2007, 2008, when I really started writing fiction. And at that point, I had been reading speculative fiction and magic realism and everything in both Spanish and English for my entire life. And I don't know why before that moment it hadn't occurred to me to write speculative fiction, but I started a novel, and it employed actually one of a legendary sort of character from Spanish colonial times called La Ciguanaba, who has the face of a horse, and essentially I've come to call that novel that never really sort of got finished, La Ciguanaba en el Norte, because she was a displaced legend, sort of dealing with the same issues that all immigrants face when they move from one country to another, from one culture to another, and need to adapt. And so So I started writing that novel, and I don't know why I launched into a novel, but to distract myself, I started writing stories. And my first story, short story that was published, it was a short story called Flying with the Dead. It was published at the tail end of 2009 by Cross Genres. And so I'm a writer that comes late into writing speculative fiction, late into writing fiction at all, and who really draws not only from my childhood in Guatemala and what was formative there, but also from now an extended period of time in the United States covering the Latino community journalistically and really being in many, many ways a U.S. Latina. So I sort of carry both the immigrant Latina and the U.S. Latina experience and write between the two in some odd sort of like tiny overlap liminal space between the two. Did I answer your questions or get stuck in only one of them?
No, you definitely answered my questions. So I know you mentioned that you sold your first story to Cross Genres. I know you've sold other stories to them, and you had your first novel out through them as well. And you've had stories elsewhere. I know I've personally edited you in Strange Horizons when I was a fiction editor there. And you've done stories at Tordon.com and Uncanny Magazine, where I currently work. And you've got all kinds of things that are all very much informed by your time growing up in Guatemala and your experiences with the Latino community in general. But I'm wondering, so when you started with Cross Genres. It really seems like you found a fit there with editors who were listening and wanted to hear your voice. Did you have trouble placing your work before that? And do you think that people who are coming from an immigrant experience have trouble with traditional publishing in the U.S.?
I hadn't really tried a lot of places before I submitted to Cross Genres. I had maybe submitted three or four pieces to sort of big name publications that I knew about. And I'm a slow writer and not a tremendously prolific writer. So when I realized when cross genres accepted my first story, I was delighted. And then very shortly thereafter, a magazine called Greatest Uncommon Denominator, Good Magazine, accepted a second one. And I thought, wow, this is amazing. This is really taking off. Well, that story has yet to see the light of day.
Oh, no.
No, it's true. It's true. This poor issue has been delayed, you know, seven or more years.
Oh.
I know. But anyway, it was a very long time after that that I really, submitted my work again. And it was really through prods from cross genres to submit to anthologies. So in a lot of ways, they really helped me navigate, you know, that odd space where I was, where I knew nothing of the speculative fiction markets, outside of the one or two, that I had heard of. I was a person who read speculative fiction in books. I would buy anthologies. I was not reading anything online. I wasn't reading any magazine work. I had no idea where to go. Had no sort of workshop peers, for example. I think one of the things that I tell some of my Latina friends who have just started writing is that one of the most significant things I realize I'm missing is that sort of peer group that you develop if you go through a Clarion or an Odyssey workshop, if you're so lucky to be able to do so. I sort of felt I was writing into a vacuum, and I was writing into a vacuum in a variety of ways. One, I was using many of the concerns and motifs that interwove both, you know, the immigrant experience and memories of Guatemala and my experiences in the United States as a U.S. Latina. And there wasn't a lot of that being published in spec fiction at that time, which is not to say that there wasn't, you know, a great deal of fantastic U.S. Latino speculative fiction, but much of it was really, you know, very, very rooted in U.S. Latino history without the sort of immigrant overlay. And so I felt really like I had to throw elbows to make a space for myself. And this is something that I had a great deal of sort of experience with in terms of the journalism world. There aren't a lot of Latino journalists in most newsrooms, and many of them are sort of at the lowest rank of reporter. Very few of them at editor level, and often there's a huge disconnect between the English language media and the Latino media on both sides. Well, you know, there's a sense of isolation, but also, you know, there's a sense that the English language media has no clue what the Spanish language media is doing or the caliber of work that it's doing, and there's very, very little overlap or shared space. And I felt like I was really throwing elbows in both my day job and my, you know, and my vocation, my secret vocation, trying to make space for what I understood just as a news person, as a U.S. citizen, as somebody who had lived here a long time, was going to be a growing, more vital voice in the United States, which was not necessarily Latino, but the immigrant voice and the immigrant experience, and to give that space to sort of live. What I found very early on is that people, when my work did get noticed by, you know, if it ever got reviewed at Locus, for example, it was clearly culturally outside of what people were willing to look at as speculative. I cannot tell you how many times I have read that my work isn't speculative, except sort of coincidentally, which always amuses me to no end. Because I also hear from you know, I have, you know, a certain number of very close people in my life who are part of the literary fiction world, and every once in a while I'll hear this plaintive sort of like, aren't you ever going to like just write literary stuff without the speculative end?
Oh.
So, you know, it's interesting, and I think that part of that sort of reaction to my work, from that critical reaction to my work, is because of its very focus on the immigration experience and its focus on you know, the memories of the undeclared Civil War and how that plays out in the United States in people who have come here, and it all sort of seems hard for some people to see that as somehow an underpinning for speculative fiction. But I do feel like a lot has changed in the time I've been part of the spec fic world. I really have seen an opening up. I see a lot more immigrant speculative fiction authors who have really significant roles and whose voices have become really important and recognized. And I think that initial feeling that I had, that my work was sort of meeting with a little bit of resistance and maybe a little bit of sort of a provincial understanding of what speculative fiction should be, I think that, you know, I'm not going to say that it's gone, but I think it's transformed. In the time that I've been writing, I really, or maybe because I was such an outsider to it, it seemed that way to me. It seemed more hermetic to me. And as I have, you know, slowly become, you know, gotten more inside, all of a sudden I realize it's not that hermetic. You know, what do you think? Do you feel like in the past, you know, nearly 10 years, that there's been a shift in the speculative fiction world and an opening?
That's really hard for me to say, because that's about the time span that I've been really moving within this world. And I started knowing no one and have built a community. And now I have a really big and wonderful, thriving community around me, which includes all kinds of people who are very open and very welcoming of people. But I don't know how much that has changed, because it's exactly my time frame of experience.
Huh. Interesting.
So I feel like maybe you and I are kind of coming in at the same time.
Yeah, you know, and it's funny because for me, you know, like I think of you as somebody who was already, you know, really established, and probably because, you know, like I first encountered you as an editor at Strange Horizons, and so for me you were like, ooh, you know, this is the spec fic world that, you know, I was just sort of dancing around.
Right, but you really encountered me as an editor during my first year as an editor, and before that I had done a little bit of writing, but I was operating in the same kind of space where I didn't know very many people when I started out. I attended Viable Paradise in 2009, and that gave me a peer group, which was great, but that was pretty much, you know, the members of that class. And then I attended more conventions, and as I did that, I kind of got more involved, and I was part of the Outer Alliance, which does activism for LGBTQ people. So there was kind of like a few different axes from which I was kind of getting myself into the community. And of course, Bart and Kay, who run Cross Genres, or who ran Cross Genres, because no longer around really anymore, they were part of the Outer Alliance too. So that's how I got to know them. And I believe that's how I first encountered your work, because I had known who they were from the Outer Alliance. And then I picked up Fat Girl in a Strange Land. And the first thing I ever read by you was La Gorda and the City of Silver, which is a short story about a fat girl who is a sort of lucha libre superhero, and it's wonderful and I love it.
It's interesting, you know, I think I've said this before. It is, without question, the most beloved of my stories. People really, really like La Gorda in a way that, you know, that I don't think that, I mean, they might like the rest of my work and they might, you know, think highly of whatever, but La Gorda seems to be the story that people really, that they really love on some level with their, you know, it's a heart reaction. It's not a brain reaction. And I think it's interesting because that one's actually set in Guatemala. So, you know, I wouldn't have expected that it, of all of the stories, would be the one that that would resonate with people, but it does.
Well, I love all of your work, but I will say that the thing that stands out to me about that particular story is that it's very heartwarming.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of your other pieces are more difficult. They provoke a lot of hard thoughts and feelings, and that is so important, but also there's something to be said for people being able to connect with something that just kind of ends up making them feel good.
You know, and increasingly I understand that, although, you know, I suspect that it's one of the things that I'm really going to have to work at now, in particular, when people are really terrified. And, you know, around me, so many of the undocumented immigrants that I know are really, you know, sort of they're prepping their lives to be completely disrupted. They're prepping, they're doing things that are really, really hard, you know, figuring out who to give guardianship of your children to.
Right.
Because you need to prepare that. You need to have a plan that says, you know, when I get picked up, when I, you know, enter into detention and deportation proceedings, what happens to the significant portions of my life? And I find myself, you know, I'm a person who, you know, I think it's partially temperament and partially the discipline of journalism that I tend to focus on thorny, difficult stories that don't have, you know, that don't necessarily have a heartwarming resolution. But I do think that there's this fine line that we need to craft where to hold back despair. And so I sort of sense that I'm going to have to push myself beyond my own despair and my own, you know, feelings of being overwhelmed, and also, you know, just recognizing aspects of what I lived through in Guatemala sort of threatening us here. And really have to push myself to do a few more heartwarming pieces, because I think it's important that we do what we can to keep hope afloat.
That's really interesting that your focus is maybe trying to change a little bit in the face of all of this. I think telling those difficult stories is also really important, but I think your reasoning for wanting to try to move toward the things that can give us hope is really important too. And I think it's fascinating that that's some of the shift in your perspective that has happened. Before we wrap up really quickly, I know you had talked to me before about the difficulties of people being published in different languages coming over and having success in the English language. And particularly, you were talking to me earlier about Daina Chaviano, who is a Cuban writer. I wondered if you would talk to me a little bit more about that, and assume, of course, that anyone listening has never heard of her and knows nothing. What are some of the problems that you see people facing when they try to get published in English? And what would you recommend that we do about that?
Yeah, one of the things that it stuns me, because... Because, you know, Daina it has a huge following in Spanish language science fiction and fantasy. I mean, she is considered one of the sort of this triad of women science fiction writers in Spanish, science fiction fantasy writers in Spanish. That includes an Argentine writer whose name I can never remember, but I think it's Angela.
Gorodischer, something like that. I always get her name wrong, but I know who you're talking about.
I do too. I'm terrible with it, and so I don't even attempt it anymore. But so Diana and Angelica, and then there's a third person who I don't know. But they're really significant figures in Spanish language sci-fi and fantasy, and yet because they're published in Spanish mostly, and rarely translated, there's no overlap between their enormous followings in Spanish and sort of the English language speculative fiction world. I think one of the really great things about Latino Rising, which is the anthology that came out in January of this year, edited by Matt Goodwin, and I have a piece in it, and a number of other people like Daniel Jose Older and Carlos Hernandez and Ernest Hogan, who are, you know, big part of the U.S. Latino scene. But it also brings in people who have, who are writing speculative fiction, who have a bigger name really in the literary world, or people like Diana, who have this enormous reputation and following, but have only had one book translated. And I think that that's the crux of it, right, is the translating part. And getting the willingness maybe of online magazines to engage a translator, to maybe sort of build into their budgets, you know, a certain amount of funding for translating a work from a different language. I saw this, interestingly enough, you know, there was the, I'm sure you saw that there was a little bit of a talk about an anthology sort of based on Elizabeth Warren's, you know, sort of being told, you know, to quiet down, but nevertheless she persisted. And one of the things, I brought Diana, you know, all of us were sort of like brainstorming different writers to ask to be part of it, and I tagged Diana in it, and Diana immediately answered. And this is interesting, because this is a little bit like, say, you know, for English language, this is a little bit like Ursula Le Guin immediately answering, right? I mean, that magnitude of importance in the Spanish language sci-fi speculative world. And so the first thing she said is, I really would love to participate, but I write in Spanish and I can't translate my own work. And so, you know, that precipitates then a conversation about, if you want to have a genuinely rich and expansive view of what speculative fiction is, not only for us in the United States, but for, you know, for the world, but also for subsets of folks in the United States who are writing in different languages and generally being published by a language, a secondary language imprint of big publishers, you know, there's going to have to be a certain allocation of money to be able to do that, to bring those voices in. It's not always going to be possible for, you know, for people like Ken Liu to translate a book and then have us realize, wow, this is an amazing writer that we didn't know about, and thank God that Ken translated his work. Well, you know, it's going to, I believe, going to have to be a commitment of publishers themselves to say, okay, let's allocate a certain amount of money for translation should that be necessary, and then to have also access to slush readers. Maybe, I don't know, a bureau maybe of slush readers that can, you know, read in a variety of languages so that people like Daina don't hesitate to submit their work. I mean, she's really anxious to be able to share her work in English, and she's lovely, you know, to deal with in terms of, she's been so gracious to me, who doesn't have a readership in Spanish for my fiction. I have a readership in Spanish for my journalism, but she's been very gracious about sharing, you know, like introducing me to her fandom, who doesn't know me from Adam. And so for these two worlds to coexist and in the same country is just remarkable. And I think that that's one of the things that we need to understand and address, that we're never going to really get the Latino experience or the Hungarian American experience or, you know, the Pakistani American experience or any of that, unless we can also bring in people who are writing in whatever their dominant tongue is. And I do think that the time is right for it because, you know, I go back and forth between Spanish and English. I sprinkle my pieces with a lot of Spanish language expressions. I'm sort of playing around with both languages in some of my newer work and with different, you know, sort of poetic forms that are both Spanish language and English language. And I think that there's an openness to that, for example, you know, Carlos Hernandez also, you know, sprinkles Spanish into his stuff. Daniel Jose does as well. And I think there's an openness to it now that there may not have been at one point. But I think now we really have to make the commitment that, okay, we're not only going to, you know, publish the U.S. Latino writers who write in English and Spanglish, we're also going to, like, make it possible for those who are Spanish dominant to also be a part of the spec fic world.
Yeah, I would love to see more of that. Okay, well, on that note, I would like to tell listeners that they can find some of your work for free online. They can find Stories in Uncanny and Strange Horizons, which are still available on the web.
And Tor.
Oh, and Tor.com. They can also seek out your work elsewhere just by searching for your name, and they can find things like your novel, Ink, which is amazing. And they should definitely go and do that. And thank you so much for joining us, Sabrina.
And thank you, Julia. And anytime you want to talk about, you know, some immigrant fiction that I adore, I just read E.B. Du Bois' American Street, which I think is a really fantastic novel of the immigrant experience. And, you know, I'm here for you to talk about it.
Excellent. And now I have Rose Lindberg and Bogi Tokach with me to talk about the immigrant experience in science fiction and fantasy writing in general and with their own. So we'll just start with your own experiences. And first of all, welcome to both of you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So you guys have a really interesting immigrant story that is all, I think, tangled up also in writing and editing. And I would love to hear about how you decided to come to the United States, when you came, what your experience with writing was before and after, and how that immigrant experience really informed your writing and affected it.
So I'll start, if that's okay. Mm-hmm. Since I was the first to immigrate, I'm Rose, and I came to the United States as a non-resident alien. I was an academic migrant. I came to Berkeley to do my PhD in 2001, which was a while ago. I before that was I was born in Ukraine and I lived in subarctic Russia and Israel before coming to the U.S. And I was interested in writing from very early on, but I just couldn't figure out what language to write in. And as many people who are kind of in the same boat, there's a lot of tensions that are connected to what is the native language, which things are speakable in what language. For me, many readers who know me might know me for my queer work. So that's part of the things that were causing tension, because queerness and transness were not really speakable in Russian when I was growing up. So coming as a graduate student to Berkeley in my 20s, I felt that there was just absolutely no way I could express myself. And bit by bit, as I my English, I grew more confident in my English, I decided pretty much on a lark to write in English as kind of a compromise between all my many languages. And that's how I got into SFF writing. Now, I need to preface this by the fact that the reason I dared to do it at all was Shveta Narayan, who is another, at the time, was another Berkeley graduate student, and we've met as a part of a experience of being both students of Eve Sweetser in the Berkeley Linguistics Department. And we started talking about writing and immigration, and Shveta, of course, is a migrant with many, many countries on the list of the countries where they lived. And so they started to talk to me about how it's really okay to feel the sense of liminality in language and place, and that writing science fiction is not just for white Anglo-Western people, and it's okay to try. And that's how I started writing. And in 2010, I founded Stonetelling Magazine, which is a poetry venue which is now in hiatus, and which we co-edited, Shveta and I, for 5 years. And we were explicitly looking for liminal perspectives, migrant perspectives, multilingual perspectives, queer perspectives in speculative poetry, because we felt that it was just there wasn't really a place for it before. And as I was asking for bilingual poetry, one of the first bilingual submissions I've got was from a certain Bogi Tokaj, a Hungarian Jewish writer, who was completely unknown to me, but became known to me through this bilingual poem about aliens and anti-Semitism. I will then pass the flag of speaking to you, Bogi.
Yes. Yes, thank you. I sent that poem to Rose and Shveta, and it was also later reprinted in an anthology specifically focusing on immigrant narratives in SFF, edited by Joan Merriam, How to Live on Other Planets. But before that, so I submitted this poem, and Rose asked for a rewrite request, which took me about a year and a half.
2 years.
Okay. 2 years. Of much agonizing. I'm usually very slow with rewrite requests. Eventually I finished it, and we got to know each other and started talking. And I also got to know Shveta Narayan, who really encouraged me to start blogging in English, and even donated a Hugo membership for me so that I would talk about what works I would nominate. This was way before the recent controversies. This was like 6 years ago, maybe?
Yeah.
Five? Something along those lines. Yes. And that was when I started blogging about SFF in English, and also increasingly started to write SFF in English. At that point, I had felt that there was little reason for me to write in Hungarian. I had a few stories published in Hungarian, and also I spent probably over a decade blogging about SFF in Hungarian. But I eventually stopped because I just experienced so much hostility and a lot of anti-Semitism, and I just felt like that it was really an uphill battle, and I just felt like there wasn't really a lot of point in writing in Hungarian. But also, it took me a long while to feel that I was confident enough to write in English. I started writing and publishing in English before I moved to the U.S., and this was a bit weird because people sometimes outright refuse to believe me that they would tell me that I must live in an anglophonic country, and I was like, no. So it was really frustrating and bizarre, especially also since I got the impression that if they would meet me in person, it would be obvious. Right. But from my writing, it wasn't obvious. Eventually I ended up moving to the US. I lived previously for a short while in Austria and also in Norway, both times on academic fellowships. And I also came to the US on a student visa and working on my PhD at the University of Iowa, which I'm still doing. And
we're married.
Yes, we ended up getting married. Not immediately, but
eventually
we ended up getting married. And I changed my visa status. So now I'm a permanent resident of the United States. And yes, and I also now have a stepchild who taught me the Pledge of Allegiance.
Who's not talking very well, but the Pledge of Allegiance he has been able to recite.
Yes, with great enthusiasm.
Great enthusiasm.
And likes reading about the Supreme Court and things like that. So I get my civic education now, like kind of vicariously through him. And in the meanwhile, I think I continued writing in English. It was a bit difficult because for a while I was in a student visa, I wasn't allowed to actually accept payment from off-campus sources. So I couldn't really accept payment from venues. And it was really dispiriting, but I kept on writing and publishing, even knowing that I wouldn't really be able to derive a financial benefit from it. Well, now I'm on a green card, so now I'm able to get payment, which has resulted in a much improvement in my finances.
So I think that one of the things that I really want to mention, following up on what Bogi said, is how much SFF people are really not aware of immigration as an axis of oppression until very, very recently.
Yeah.
So I've done a fair amount of talking about it, and Bogi has done a fair amount of talking about it, and I know other people talk about it. But even talking about it is dangerous. The very fact that Bogi could not receive payment and had to refuse payments was just met with
bafflement
from editors and people in SFF. And you know, I remember. I remember many years in which I was on green card, and I was even before I was my first sale was still when I was on a training grant, and I could accept payment, but I had to make phone calls. I consulted whether I was able to accept payment or no. Sometimes they give you really harsh answers. For example, Bogie was threatened with basically, you know, horrible consequences if they would accept payment, and it was just so shocking that a $5 coupon would inspire scrutiny from certain quarters.
Yeah.
But it's true.
Yep.
And even discussing immigrant experience in this day and age, where there's this increased scrutiny upon what migrants say and what certain people say, it just feels very fraught. And at the same time, both of us felt that SFF really didn't imagine this as an axis of oppression. There's not that many migrants in the field. There are more now, I feel, than there used to be, and people are speaking up about it. But for example, we were trying to come up with people we want to talk about. We both discussed that there's no lists, there's no resources,
database or anything.
And a lot of people who write about immigration experiences are not, those are not first person experiences, but rather their parents' experiences or grandparents' experiences or imagined experiences rather than their own voices' experiences. So, Bogi, do you want to add something about
that? Yeah, I just wanted to mention that it was really striking to me about 2 years ago when I was writing an article for Jim Hines' project Invisible 2 about migrant experience in SFF, and I was trying to find people's works to cite, and it was really surprising to me that there was only a single anthology in all of English language SFF that specifically focused on migration. This is the Joan Merriam anthology I just mentioned, and even that was I'm not sure if primarily or exclusively a reprints anthology.
But also Latino Rising, you wanted to.
Yes, I wanted to mention that there is also now Latino Rising, which focuses on Latinx writers, but also, as the foreword describes, the editor would have liked to emphasize immigrant experiences. So that anthology also now has a lot of migration-related stories, but it just came out this January. And also, it's not marketed as a migrant anthology, it's marketed as a Latinx anthology.
Right.
But overall, I think there has been more and more. And as I was preparing for this particular podcast, I found quite a few things that didn't exist back then when I was doing my previous roundup. For example, Ibi Zoboy's American Street, which is a YA magical realist novel, which just came out maybe 2 weeks ago. I just finished reading it. And that was also excellent and also specifically related to migration, but again, very new. So now I think we're going to see a lot more along these lines, but yes, this is a new development.
And I'm really happy to see that there's more attention to migration, both as a social issue, as an own voices vehicle for storytelling. I also wanted to briefly mention that poetry has actually been a wonderful vehicle for discussing migration and migration-related issues before there was kind of an avenue for it in fiction. So people like Brian Talwara, who immigrated as an infant from Laos, and Mia Sereno, who is a queer immigrant from the Filipinos to Australia, who is wonderful, who is also a wonderful artist and a wonderful poet. There's Shweta, who was already mentioned. There's myself and Bogi, and Qingying Chen, who is a child of Chinese immigrants, who has this wonderful poetry, prose poetry piece in the anthology An Alphabet of Embers, which I've edited, about immigration, which I'm a big fan. I mean, I published it, so obviously I'm a bit biased, but I'm a big fan. We would like to see much more writing and discussion. One of the pieces that really appealed to me as a person who has immigrated, migrated in many places, was a piece by Nicasia Reed in Stranger Horizons called The Tourist. And it's actually a nonfiction piece in which they discuss being third culture kid, which is kind of out of fashion, but the sense of liminality which accompanies migrating from place to place and not really staying in any one place, and what it does to one's writing in terms of attention to setting and kind of the sense of estrangement and wonder that comes from not really being rooted in one place, but having experiences of liminality and migration. I relate to this really hard because in my own work, I pay a lot of attention to both the setting and the language issues that come up with being a person who is liminal, being a person who moves between cultures, which is something that I would like to see more explicitly discussed, and definitely to have more own voices work along those lines.
Yeah, definitely. So I love that you gave us a list of recommendations of other people who are writing with migration and immigration experiences. One of the things that Sabrina Vorvulius brought up when I interviewed her was the difficulty of getting things translated into English. And she particularly brought up Daina Chaviani, who is a Cuban writer. I think she's Cuban, yes. And she's very, very popular in Spanish language science fiction and fantasy, but doesn't have a lot of work in English. She does have one story in Latino Rising, which the editor translated. So that's how that actually got there. But Sabrina was saying it's very frustrating that there's this person who, and she's not the only one, obviously, who's very big in all of the Spanish-speaking science fiction and fantasy world. And yet, even when she's here, people don't know who she is. So I wondered what your experience of science fiction and fantasy writers in countries where you've lived other than English-speaking countries has been, and whether you've seen any good signs of translation or have any hopes for that or have any difficulties with that.
There's not a lot of translated SF from Hungarian, and also I think in part the trouble is that there's not a lot of people interested in doing that kind of translation work, especially because there's not a lot of funding for it. For example, if we take a look at which languages a translated SF is from, it's very frequently from the Nordic countries, especially mm-hmm. Finland, when there are state-sponsored grants to be able for translators and publishers also to be able to finance the translations. And something similar in Hungary, there are small initiatives, but they're not almost, but exclusively literary focused and especially poetry focused, and there's not really room for translating SFF. There are very few people currently writing who have English language work. Sheila Kleinhans has a few stories, and some of which have also been reprinted in Interfictions, but there's not a lot beside that. I made a list of Eastern European people in general who are active in English language SFF in the sense that they participate themselves and not just like somebody else translated their work, but they are active themselves. And it's not a very long list. Even though I included all the Eastern European countries and I periodically run around and ask people to opt into it and send me the contact information they would like to be listed, because I get inquiries from publishers who ask me to find writers from those countries. And especially people who can write in English, because I think that's also a major barrier that a lot of people do not write in English. Though, of course, it is possible to be a migrant and have English as a first language, because in many countries it is a first language, but not really in Eastern Europe, obviously.
No. on your list, Bogi, there is Anatoly Berilovsky and Alex Schwarzman, both of whom are Russian-speaking Russian Americans, and both of them are keenly interested in translating work from Russian. So I know that they have done
a lot of
work in bringing Russian language science fiction, of which there's a big, huge field Russian language science fiction fantasy in Eastern Europe that gets translated into many European languages, but into English. There's like with other traditions, I'm always complaining that the translations are just not enough or not there. Just because of a general problem of finding translated work in English. But as I said, Anatoly Belilovsky and Alex Schwarzman have done a wonderful job in bringing contemporary Russian science fiction to an American audience. So I'm actually hoping to see more. I know that there's translation projects and some of the major short fiction venues going on right now.
Yeah.
So Strange Horizons just started Samovar, which is for translated works of science fiction fantasy from other languages. Uncanny had translated stories, which I think is wonderful. One of them was, of course, a Hugo winner, right, Boogie, last year?
Yes, Fold in Beijing. Yeah.
That was an excellent story.
And of course, Clark's World has a translation project. So I'm more hopeful now than I used to be, because I think that those questions of translation are coming into focus.
Yeah, and here I would absolutely like to mention Ken Liu,
yes,
who has done an immense amount of work both translating and also encouraging writers to write in English as well. So several Chinese writers now also have English language stories that were originally written in English. And also here, I think it is absolutely necessary to mention two volumes. One of them is Invisible Planets, which showcases Ken Liu's translations from Chinese. And the other one is his own story collection, Paper Menagerie and Other Stories, which has several immigration-focused stories. For example, the title story, which won pretty much all the awards that exist in SFF. But also one I really liked was All the Flavors, which is a novella that originally appeared in Giganotosaurus, which I really appreciated. And one of his stories that is sadly not in this anthology, but that really resonated with me, was To the Moon, which originally appeared in Fireside. And I also, it's also important that Ken has done a lot of work encouraging people in general, not just Chinese people, not just migrants, but all sorts of people, to increase both translated work and non-Western work and migration-related fiction in general.
There was a WorldCon panel on translated SFF last year in Kansas City. Do you remember who was on that panel?
Yeah. I know there were a bunch of people.
Alex Reisman was on it.
Yeah, Nick Wood was supposed to be on it, but he couldn't make it because of his flight.
Yes.
I have a write-up of this somewhere that we will probably be able to link on the podcast website, because there were quite a few resources and recommendations that came out of this panel. I also mentioned things like, for example, from Hungarian, there's quite a lot of magical realist work that is translated, that is in Hungary it's not seen as SFF at all. But I think here in the U.S. would absolutely be seen as speculative. For example, George Dragoman's work, which has garnered a lot of major awards and has been translated to many different languages, White King and Bonfire, which are both very much worth reading, but also very firmly magical realist, and I think absolutely falling under our umbrella here.
Okay, excellent. Yes, if you want to send us the links, we would be happy to put them up in the show notes. We should wrap this interview up, but before we go, I'd love it if you could tell me and the rest of our listeners where we could find you and your work.
My work, if you go to my website, roselemberg.net, I have a bibliography section. I also have a section there on my current big project, which is my epic secondary world epic fantasy Birdverse, which is a queer, very, very queer, very trans, multicultural secondary world. And there's also my Patreon, which is Rose Lemberg, patreon.com/Rose Lemberg, where I write about Birdverse mainly, but I'm actually right now also writing a magic realist, kind of nonfiction-y, kind of memoir-like piece called Intricacies, which is actually about immigrations. It's all about immigrations. And I've been sharing pieces of that also on my Patreon, so people who are interested in that could find me. I'm on Twitter as Rose Lemberg as well, so that's a good place too.
Yeah. I'm on pretty much all variants of social media as Boogie Person. So on Twitter, Instagram, and also my Patreon is under patreon.com/boogieperson. So those are relatively easy to find. And I have a bunch of websites. My writer website, which needs to be revamped a bit, is www.prezzey.net, Prezzy, which used to be my previous username. And I blog a lot about books and SFF-related media at boogiereadstheworld.com, which is probably one of the better places to find me. I try to update multiple times a week. And also I have a web serial, which coincidentally, maybe not so coincidentally, features two protagonists who are both migrants. www.iwunen.net, which is spelled like I-W-U-N-E-N. I hope I spelled it right. Oh my god. I can't
spell in English.
Okay. So those are various places where I can be found. I write a lot of science fiction. I probably write more science fiction than fantasy, and a lot of it is inspired by my day job doing research related to language disorders. So that's probably it in a nutshell.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. Yes, we're really glad.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can find us at skiffyandfanty@gmail.com, on Twitter at skiffyandfanty, on Facebook at The Skiffy and Fanty Show, and on Patreon at patreon.com/skiffyandfanty. Our intro and outro music comes from The Launch by Cronux. You can find out more about their music at freemusicarchive.org.